Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the afternoon magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for joining us today. When you think of Niagara Falls, do you think of honeymooners of years ago, or do you think of the power of the falls? Ferdy Groffé was inspired by both when he composed his Niagara Falls Suite in 1961. In addition to honeymooners and the power of the falls, his Niagara Falls Suite includes Indian motifs and a passage dedicated to the Devil's Hole Massacre of 1763. Niagara Falls conjures much in our imaginations. As a college student, Ginger Strand visited Niagara Falls. She went to laugh at its kitsch. Some years later, she went back and became obsessed with the place. She says Niagara Falls is one of those places with so many meanings layered onto it, it's almost hard to see. She says it has a lot to tell us about nature and our construct of nature. Same for our history. Ginger Strand writes about her investigation and obsession of the falls in the new book, Inventing Niagara, Beauty, Power, and Lies. And she's our guest in this portion of the program. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. Have you visited Niagara Falls? Tell us about it. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455. Ginger Strand is a writer of fiction and essays. Her work has appeared in many publications, including Harper's, the Iowa Review, and Orion, where she's a contributing editor. You'll find her online at www.gingerstrand.com. Her book, Inventing Niagara, Beauty, Power, and Lies, is published by Simon & Schuster. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ginger, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, tell us about that first trip you took to Niagara Falls when you were a college student.
Well, that was the big surprise, I guess. I, like a lot of college students, I had an overdeveloped sense of the ironic. And I headed off with my college boyfriend to kind of collect some kitschy souvenirs, and we were really hoping to get a heart-shaped jacuzzi or something like that in our hotel room. And we arrived at the falls, and I stepped out of the car, and I was just overwhelmed. I didn't expect it at all. And that was the natural beauty of the place and the kind of overwhelming sound of the falls that a lot of commentators write about. And just the feeling that, whoa, this thing is truly stupendous.
Yeah. Now, when did you begin to feel that there was more than the big show?
Well, it started with a tour of the power plant on the Canadian side. The American side doesn't give tours of their power plant anymore, although they have an excellent visitor center. But the Canadian plant does a little tour, and they take you inside, and they kind of show you the turbines, and they tell you how it's all done. And this was many years later, of course, and at that point I realized that half to three-quarters of the water never goes over the falls, and that this giant thing that I thought of as a natural wonder was, in fact, completely controlled by humans. And I kind of love those contradictions, so I just became, at that point, that's when the obsession truly began.
Yeah, I had no idea that the falls are turned up for the tourists, like a kind of like a faucet.
Yeah, like a fancy massaging shower head.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, even though we kind of think of them as this big symbol of American manifest destiny and, you know, the American landscape, in fact, the reason they exist at all is because we have a fantastic international treaty with Canada that's, you know, where we agree to go halvesies on the water and not to take too much away when the tourists are there.
Yeah, that's good news. I thought when I learned that the date for when the falls are turned up, I had to laugh. It's April Fool's Day.
Yeah.
April 1st is when they turn it up.
It's kind of appropriate.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting also, I've never been there. It's interesting to see the differences on the Canadian side and how it differs from the American side. The Canadian side is kind of like a big amusement park kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And on the American side, it's really run down at the heels.
Yeah, most Americans are shocked and appalled when they arrive in Niagara Falls, New York. They didn't, you know, they might have expected it to be tacky or kitschy, but they don't expect it to be as economically depressed as it is. And it's, you know, it's a common Midwestern Rust Belt sort of phenomenon. A city that used to be highly industrial is now, you know, has lost half of its population and more than half of its jobs. And they are trying to play catch up with the Canadians as far as developing what they call the tourist resource.
Yeah, so do American tourists just immediately head across the border?
A lot of them do, yeah. And, you know, the roads for the last decade or so have pretty much led you straight to the Rainbow Bridge. I say in the book, it's as if the town is almost embarrassed and wants to hurry you across the border into Canada before you kind of notice how run down it is. But that's changing now. You know, there's some interesting urban renewal projects going on at the falls, and people are being smarter about reconnecting the town to its waterfall and, you know, not hurrying the tourists out of town on a freeway.
Yeah. How do the townsfolk view your book, Inventing Niagara?
Well, you know, I became friends with a lot of people in the town while I was working on the book for about 3 years. I spent a lot of time up there just kind of hanging around and eating donuts and, you know, sometimes going to the bar with the locals. And it was, you know, I think probably the most exciting moment for me in publishing this book was being able to send a copy of it to every single person who helped me out and talked to me. And they're incredible, warm people, you know, a little suspicious at first of an out-of-towner showing up and wanting to write about them, but I think that we warmed to each other over the course of working on the book, and I feel like I have a lot of friends there. Mm. I'm not sure how everyone in town will take it, but I certainly see the book as a love letter.
Yeah.
To the falls, warts and all.
Yeah, I think people will realize right away that you're rooting for those folks.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And for the falls themselves, you know, in spite of the fact that I have been accused of being iconoclastic in kind of pointing out that they're completely controlled by humans, I still think they're a wonderful, incredible, natural spectacle, and I like that contradiction.
And you keep taking pictures.
Way too many pictures.
Yeah.
I've got to stop.
Yeah.
But no one can help themselves at the falls.
Well, some of the friends you made at Niagara Falls, we're at the Niagara Falls Public Library. You want to tell us about the library and the librarians?
Well, librarians are, you know, the salt of the earth and the most important people in the world to me. They were stupendous and kind of guided me through the whole process of, you know, I just turned up one day at the Niagara Falls Public Library, which has a stupendous local history collection, and said, hey, I'm writing a book about the falls. And they kind of rolled their eyes, like, I think they get a lot of that. And then they just began to produce things for me and began to talk to me about it and suggest that other people I might go and talk to. You know, they knew not only what the interesting books were, but where the interesting people were and what the interesting issues were. And they were just incredible. And a host of librarians at other libraries as well.
Yeah, yeah. One of the librarians, though, at some point said to you, you kept asking questions about, well, why do we have this version of the story and not really what happened? And I believe she used the term the memory hole.
Yeah.
Talk with us about the memory hole and what she was getting at.
Yeah, well, this is sort of the crux of the whole thing. The thing that kept feeding my obsession was that I kept discovering things about Niagara Falls that I had no idea about, things like that it was one of the key points for fugitive slaves to cross over into Canada, that it was one of the key sites for the refining of uranium for the production of the bomb during the Manhattan Project, that it was, you know, the birth of America's chemical industry was there, and hence the birth of America's, you know, toxic waste problem. All these things that I'd never kind of imagined would be true of this little town would suddenly turn up. And, you know, she was sort of pointing out that the history, perhaps because the waterfall is just this large, stupendous, overwhelming thing in the middle of town, it tends to drown out everything else, and people kind of arrive and look at the waterfall and don't realize how much other interesting history and how many other interesting stories there are. And there's a little bit of an attempt to repress a lot of it because, you know, you don't want to know that you've got a natural wonder, an iconic American natural wonder and an iconic Canadian natural wonder that, you know, has uranium going over it as happened during the Manhattan Project.
Mm.
So she came up with that great term, the memory hole.
The memory hole.
I had to quote her on that.
Yeah.
I think she borrowed it, but she was the one who used it to describe Niagara.
I think also, you know, when you write that the falls have a lot to tell us about nature and history, you see how, like, the landscape of the falls, we can, to paraphrase you, manicure, landscape, and manage history.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that looking at the untold story of the landscape is an important way of kind of reconstructing our history and retelling our history and coming to a better understanding of it, particularly now when we need to kind of rethink our relationship to the environment and how we're going to live in and, you know, still be able to utilize nature.
Have stories about the falls and events that may or may not have taken place changed over the years?
Oh, definitely. You know, the story of the schooner Michigan, the infamous schooner Michigan, which was in the late 1820s, was kind of packed with animals, bears, a couple bears, some geese, a dog, and sent over the falls just for the spectacle of it. That story was told in all the 19th century guidebooks. That was just considered, you know, wow, this was a really cool thing. Wish we could have seen this. And thousands of people lined the banks to see it, and it was the first big kind of, wasn't really a daredevil stunt, but it was the first big stunt that was done at Niagara that used Niagara as a background. And that story kind of falls out of the guidebooks. It just becomes a little too, ew, a little too disturbing. We don't really want to think about that.
Oh, no, we want our destinations to be, you know, well-managed, right?
Yeah.
Well, that stunt was an effort to, you know, boost tourism back in the 19th century.
Yep.
Who was responsible for that?
That was some local hoteliers in town. A trio, Canadian and American, got together. And then they also worked together with, you know, all the town's leading citizens. Everyone was, you know, very into this. It was going to, you know, bring more people to town in the off season. They did it in September. Niagara's constantly trying to figure out ways to bring people to town outside of the summer months.
Hmm. When did tourism begin to take shape in the U.S.? Who were the first tourists who went and traveled to go see something and experience something?
I think that's a fascinating story because it really gets going. It kind of, you know, American tourism was invented by the English. The English had this thing they called the Grand Tour in Europe where they hit the highlights of culture and ancient history and nature all together, and it would take them several months, and they would travel around and see the Alps and go to Italy and French castles and things. And then as people began to be interested in the young America in the early 1800s, they wanted to do similar things. They wanted to come over here and see the U.S., but it was more difficult to travel in the U.S. There were large stretches of the country where the roads were just appalling. I read some fantastic early journals where people talk about taking the stagecoach and having to, it was raining and the road was so muddy that the men all had to get out and help lever the stagecoach out of the mud as they were traveling. Mm. And they were just jolted and bounced along, and it was sort of awful. And so with the, as far as upstate New York, western New York, and sort of Canada, Ontario sites go, it was the Erie Canal that was completed in 1825 that suddenly made tourism possible. And right away, this tourist itinerary developed, and they called it the Northern Tour, and people traveled all around, and they would go to see Albany, and they would go to see the Auburn State Prison, and it was, again, a combination of kind of human-made and natural sites, and the apex of the Northern Tour was Niagara Falls, and that's when tourism really picked up there, but it was at the same time that it kind of picked up everywhere else in the U.S.
Yeah. Was it at about that time that the museum opened?
Yes. Yes, it was. 1830, roughly. Yeah. We don't exactly know for sure, but right around there is when the Barnett family opened the Niagara Falls Museum, which was a truly stupendous cabinet of curiosities right at the edge of the waterfall.
And what did it contain?
Well, it began with Thomas Barnett's collection of natural history. So he was a great lover of natural history, and he considered himself a scientific man. He didn't think of himself as a sort of Barnum-like character. And he collected shells and butterflies and minerals, and he was a very talented taxidermist, and he stuffed and mounted many animals, local and more exotic ones, when he could get his hands on them. And he had bones, he had fossils. He was, very avid about those things. And later the museum began to add exotic artifacts from other lands, human artifacts, including, of course, in the 1850s, a collection of mummies that turned out to have a rather surprising secret. One of them actually turned out to be the Pharaoh Ramses I, to everyone's great shock and surprise.
Mm.
So he had quite an amazing collection of stuff in that museum.
Yeah. And then now let's talk about a fellow who is a little Barnum-like, an interesting character with a dog named Ramses, Billy Jameson.
Billy Jameson is a wonderful person. Here's this poor guy. You have to think he's minding his own business in a way. He bought the collection of the Niagara Falls Museum, and he went in there, and everyone was pretty much just the scholars and the Egyptologists and the art collectors all kind of turned up their nose at the Niagara Falls Museum because it was this tacky cabinet of curiosities at the brink of Niagara Falls. And Billy just had a love of it. He was at the time selling shrunken heads and traveling down to Ecuador quite a bit and also beginning to collect tribal artifacts. And one day he was in the Niagara Falls Museum and he thought he might do a trade with them, some of their tribal art for one of his shrunken heads. And he asked the person he thought was the manager, "Do you want to do a trade?" And the guy said, "No, I don't really like to tamper with the collection. I like to keep it all together." And Billy just on a whim said, "Well, sell me the whole thing then." And the owner was he was open to that because the museum was struggling. It was really, there was a leak in the roof, and the tourists just kind of came and wrote their name on the whale skeleton, and there were just, it was not treated with any respect or really admiration at all. And he could see, the owner of the museum, Jacob Sherman, could see that Billy Jameson really had an appreciation for it. So he sold it to Billy. And Billy brought in some people, and he had some parts of it appraised, and he decided to sell the mummies. And the Michael Carlos Museum at Emory University bought the mummies and then subsequently proved that one of them was Ramses I. So it was big news, and everyone was shocked to find that there was something of value in the Niagara Falls Museum. And Billy still has, you know, most of the collection in his apartment in Toronto, and it's beautiful and quite stunning.
Yeah, yeah.
It was full of valuable artifacts that no one had been able to see because of their context. And it's once again that association of Niagara with kitsch kind of got in the way of people seeing that, in fact, there was something of value there.
Writer Ginger Strand is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Inventing Niagara, Beauty, Power, and Lies. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Join us with a question, a comment. Maybe you've been to Niagara Falls. Maybe you'd like to talk with us about your experience. Well, the first Europeans to see the falls, how did they describe it?
They said, frankly, it was hideous. They thought the word hideous comes up a lot. The word horrible comes up a lot. They just really didn't see much beauty in it at all. It was this giant, you know, monstrous thing, difficult to get to, even harder to get across, standing in their way. You know, it was standing between them and more beaver pelts. And so they, you know, the first person to actually write about Niagara Falls in print was a French Recollect priest named Father Louis Hennepin. And Hennepin just goes on and on about the awful sound and the horrible boiling water and the snakes and the difficult road and how awful it is to get there and the dangerous Indians. And he's just, you know, completely overwhelmed in an entirely different way.
Yeah, well, when was the first person to come along, the first European to come along and go, wow, this is great?
Well, you know, that in a way, that would be the explorer La Salle, who was with Hennepin. Hennepin was his priest on his exploration mission. La Salle didn't really appreciate the beauty of the fall, but as soon as he saw it, he knew that this was a really key point, that the important thing to do would be to build a fort here and get control of this particular juncture. And, in fact, he did build a small fort there, and he built a ship that he set sail on Lake Erie, and it became the first sailing ship to ply the upper Great Lakes. He sailed right into Huron and Michigan and Superior and collected furs, and the local Senecas were very unhappy about this because they could see that he was eliminating them as the middleman in the fur trade. So it immediately became a kind of contested site of commerce.
And did this, in fact, then lead us to disputes and to conflict?
To some extent, yes. Yeah. The ship that La Salle built was called the Griffin, and it lies at the bottom of the Great Lakes somewhere. We don't know exactly where. There are a couple shipwrecks that are kind of proposed as possibly it. But La Salle was not on the ship when it was sunk, and he kind of suspected that it was sunk by Native Americans as payback, or as, you know, just not wanting him to get in the middle of their trade routes. They also burnt down his fort after he left, so they kind of left a very clear message to La Salle, like, you know, this is our spot, and don't be trying to get in the middle of it.
Yeah. Let's take a call. We've got a listener waiting to talk with you in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The book sounds absolutely fascinating. I have been to Niagara Falls. I went the first time about 20 years ago and drove from here to Detroit and crossed over into Windsor and went to the Canadian side of the falls. And it was spectacular. It was beautiful, and we rode the Maid of the Mist and all that. And just last April, not this past April, but a year ago, over the Easter weekend, I went with my husband to pick up a boat. And we, of course, foolishly thought we would avoid snow if we waited till April. There was lots of snow. And we went to the American side. We were near Buffalo, and we said, let's go to the American side of the fall. And I thought it was as spectacular, or if not more spectacular, with the weather, because we went and the ice, there was ice forming on the railings. I mean, it was quite tricky navigating it, but it was absolutely beautiful. It was so beautiful that we went back that night, despite the wind and the cold, to see it lit up, and it was just gorgeous. So I really think to appreciate the falls, you have to go to both sides.
I am so glad you said that. I'm so glad you brought that up, because, well, there are two points that you make very well, and one is, you know, that the falls are kind of just, they're just as spectacular in winter as they are in summer, and the ice formations are amazing, and it's incredible to go there and see that happening, and the way the mist kind of coats all of the trees, and it becomes this crystal city almost.
Mm-hmm.
And the American side, which tends to be ignored by a lot of tourists, it's incredible, because when you go on to Goat Island, you get up close and personal with the rapids and with the waterfall, and it's a different experience.
You're so close to it. I mean, it was kind of scary how close you were to it, especially with ice coating everything.
Did it seem like it was tempting you to your doom?
No. I have a very strong will to survive, but you really, the power of it was awesome. And it just, I really think to say you've gone to Niagara Falls, you have to go to both sides. And even though I've been to both sides, I want to go back. And now I didn't know about them turning it up and turning it down. And I was there after April 1st. So I'm like, well, I need to go there now before April 1st, although it's pretty tricky with the weather.
Definitely. Or after October 15th. So maybe you could do a sort of a fall tour.
that sounds a little safer.
I will second your point. I think that to truly see the falls, you need to see both sides. They're completely different experiences.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to going out and finding your book.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I think fall would be a really lovely time to go to that part of the country.
Oh, it's stunning. It is so stunning in the fall. It's the colors and the apples. It's beautiful.
How do guidebooks today talk about the falls?
Guidebooks pretty much, you know, assure you that the falls are what you want them to be. They talk about the stupendous natural beauty, and they usually kind of say, well, there's all this kitschy stuff around the falls, but don't worry. Don't worry. If you go to the right places and look at the falls in the right way, you know, you'll have the sublime experience of natural wonder. And that's true, of course. But it also isn't the full story.
Yeah. Other calls are invited this afternoon for our guest, Ginger Strand. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Ginger Strand, is the author of Inventing Niagara, Beauty, Power, and Lies. You talked with the caller a little bit about the power of it, and, you know, there it is, almost calling you, and not only that, but when the listener was there, it was slippery, and kind of that added a little danger to it. And this gets me to thinking about the daredevils. When did that happen? The schooner, the Michigan schooner stunt was a stunt, but when did people start doing the tightrope walking and, you know, trying to go over in a barrel and that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, the first stunter usually is, you know, person who's considered a stunter is a guy named Sam Patch, who went around to waterfalls all around the Northeast and jumped into them. That was his thing. And that was not so exciting. I think the first person who really made the whole nation sit up and take notice of not only Niagara but the spectacle was the French aerialist Blondin, who strung a tightrope from the American side to the Canadian side of the gorge and spent two summers performing incredible tricks on this tightrope, the most kind of famous and awesome of which was carrying his manager across on his back, which was absolutely, apparently, harrowing for the people who watched. They weren't enjoying it in the least. They were just in despair for fear he would drop the man. And as far as people going over in barrels, I talk about in the book how it's a perpetual disappointment to history, history with a capital H, that the first person to succeed in going over Niagara Falls in a barrel was a 63-year-old woman, a dancing teacher from Bay City, Michigan, named Annie Taylor, who was broke, needed some money, and decided she would start a road show by making herself famous. And the way she chose to do that was to pack herself into a barrel with her kitten and go over Niagara Falls. And it was a crazy scheme. And the sad thing about poor Annie is that it didn't even work because she wasn't young or beautiful enough to go on the road show. She was cheated by her own manager, who went on the road show, stole her barrel, and went on the road show without her, hired someone young and beautiful to pose as her. So poor Annie died destitute on the streets of Niagara Falls.
Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, this is somebody I've been married for 50 years, and we spent our honeymoon over Niagara Falls, and that's an incredible impression. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. I think the listener...
A Niagara honeymooner calling in. Yeah, that is certainly one of the best-known traditions at Niagara.
When and how did it become a destination for honeymooners?
Pretty much the minute it became a destination for tourists, because the honeymoon, what a lot of people don't realize is that it's a fairly new tradition. It only really started happening in the 1800s, in the mid-1800s. And so people began to take what they first called bridal tours, and they went to the sites that the other tourists went to, which included Niagara. And then it became a kind of, I think what I noticed when I was looking at the history of honeymooning was that people became very attached to the Niagara honeymoon at moments where we were trying to kind of pull together as a nation. And it's one of these things that we like having a unified national culture. We like having these things that we all understand and we all do, you know, despite our many, many differences in the nation. And so after the Civil War is really when the Niagara honeymoon became extremely popular to talk about. There's songs written about it and pictures of honeymooners published in magazines like Harper's. And it happened again after the Second World War.
Yeah, you know, I can't remember if this is for certain or not, but I believe my parents went there not long after they were married. I don't know if it was their honeymoon, but they went there. It would have been 1950, 1951.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah.
So. It's an extremely common story. It's kind of amazing what percentage of the population from a certain, you know, era went to Niagara on their honeymoon.
Is it still popular for honeymooners?
It's not so much. You know, the whole role of the honeymoon has changed, and Niagara has changed, and people don't really want a honeymoon that's kind of down market and kitschy. So they tend... Some people still do go and still look for the connection to the past that way, but I think it fell out of favor in the more kind of, you know, particularly in the 80s and the affluent decade, and people started going to more glamorous places like Fiji and Tahiti and stuff, and it hasn't really shaped itself as a romantic destination. It certainly can be romantic, but it's a very family-oriented destination these days, so it's not as popular, Although I do talk about the fact that Canada's legalization of gay marriage is creating a whole new honeymoon industry there.
Yeah. I would think it would have a lot of potential. What's this place's future?
That is the big question and the interesting question. And I think, you know, there still remains a lot of incredibly beautiful nature at Niagara Falls. One of the things that people rarely do is hike down into the gorge, which you can do on the American side, and walk along the river. And there are stupendous things down there, including the ruins of a power plant that was destroyed by a landslide. So, and the river is just incredible to be up close and personal with, even below the falls. I think that there's a very strong faction of environmentalists working hard at Niagara to convince the developers to go in the direction, in a sort of ecotourism direction, as they're redeveloping the American side. And the Canadians have done some of this as well. There's a beautiful bike path along the gorge on the Canadian side, so you can rent bikes and ride all along it. I think that the attraction will eventually be more than just the falls, but include the entire Niagara Gorge.
Have there been attempts over the years to, as you call it, renature Niagara?
There's been a lot of renaturing at Niagara. Yeah. It's been constantly, you know, denatured and then renatured. The most famous instance of that, which I spend a chapter talking about, is Frederick Law Olmsted and his renaturing of the American side. And he even had a little say in what happened on the Canadian side. Olmsted, of course, being the famous co-designer of New York City's Central Park and Prospect Park and Boston's Fenway and many, many beautiful parks in the post-Civil War, pre- and post-Civil War era. He managed to lead a movement to get rid of a lot of what he considered the ugly, tacky, small-time establishments along the Niagara Gorge and create what became America's first state park, the Niagara Falls Reservation, as it was originally known. And then he redesigned it to kind of reduce the appearance of human impact. So using different kinds of fencing and platforms and stuff, and rearranging the trees. Olmsted was quite an amazing artist, and his parks create, you know, this illusion of being sort of nature, just a little slice of nature that's very well taken care of. But in fact, there are these massive engineering projects that are extremely artful.
Well, now we go to a darker side of the human hand on the landscape, and that is the Niagara's landfills. And you're quite the expert now on this. How many Superfund sites are in the county?
Oh, I'm gonna get the number wrong. I think it's 10 or 13. It changes frequently too, whether they, depending on, you know, when things get taken on and off, put on and off the list. So it's a surprising number in any case, and there are many, many, many more brownfields and sites of areas of concern, according to the Department of Environmental Protection. So, you know, the American side was a center for industry, and when the tourist industry developed at Niagara on the New York side, factories were really the main business, and Niagara Falls was one of our earliest industrial centers because they had lots and lots of cheap power.
Mm-hmm.
So they had lots of electro-intensive energies arrive, industries like aluminum that need a lot of electricity to do their business, and electrochemical, electrometallurgical, all these factories began to be built as soon as Niagara was harnessed in 1895. So there was a lot of things being manufactured at Niagara, and these particular industries also happened to be very waste intensive, so there was a lot of waste being dumped.
Why did those industries ultimately shut down and move out?
Well, you know, it's the same collection of factors that led to a lot of the shutdowns in the Rust Belt all across the center of the country, really. People going elsewhere for even cheaper power, industries going out of the nation for cheaper labor.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, you know, the aluminum industry, for instance, picked up from Niagara and moved to the Columbia River when the government built dams on the Columbia that produced even cheaper power than Niagara's.
What's become of Love Canal? What does it look like today?
Love Canal looks kind of like a sheet cake made out of grass, and you have to imagine the candles as methane vents.
Wow.
That's sort of what it looks like. It's been remediated, as they say. It's been completely capped, and it's vented, and it's fenced off. The central area of it is fenced off, and, you know, they keep a close eye on it.
Have there been follow-up studies on the people that lived there and were forced out?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I don't feel qualified to answer it. I know Lois Gibbs is still very much involved in the issue, and there are, you know, there's a lot of controversy about the question of health studies. There are always, you know, differing methodologies, and people arguing about, you know, whether this particular study is really valid or whether you can really say that there's a cancer cluster. A lot of the people too move, and so it's hard to keep track of the people who were involved.
Hmm. Let's go back to the idea of beauty. We've talked a little bit about power and lies. I suppose we've also talked about beauty. But Marilyn Monroe has a role to play in this story, a beauty who starred in a movie called Niagara.
Yep. That was really kind of her breakthrough film, and she's spectacular in it. And I, you know, watched the film many, many times and became really fascinated with the way some of the issues that Marilyn raises, both her character in that film and as a celebrity, her person, herself. And there, many of them are the same questions that are raised with regards to Niagara. You know, is it real or is it manufactured? People were always asking this about Marilyn. Is this the real her, or is it a put-on? And, of course, there's the famous Marilyn walk in the film Niagara, where she walks away from the camera and the camera lingers on her retreating behind for 16 seconds, and it made her a star. And then people later argued a lot about whether or not that was really her walk or whether, you know, she had kind of manufactured that walk. And the falls were at the same time being kind of boosted and girdled and dressed up in a very similar way to the way that Marilyn was boosted and girdled and presented to the public as a symbol of beauty.
Yeah. W.E.B. Du Bois, also a visitor to the falls. What did he see there?
He saw the legacy of freedom, and that's one of the, you know, one of the more exciting and fascinating parts of the history that I think the region is beginning to talk about more and to kind of show to tourists, but for many years was completely forgotten, the legacy of the fugitives crossing over at Niagara. They also crossed at Windsor, Detroit, which is another place where there was a narrow enough river and a bridge you could get across into Canada. But those were the two key river crossings into Canada for fugitive slaves. And in the, you know, after the Civil War, you'll just find in newspapers poems, you know, written lauding Niagara. Niagara remained a symbol of freedom to African Americans for many, many years after the Civil War. And when Du Bois founded his civil rights organization, which later became the NAACP, he first named it the Niagara Movement.
Hmm. to wrap up here, is there anything you'd like to add?
I think everybody in the nation should go to Niagara Falls. you know, I think, as I said, I think at the beginning, it's my book is to a great extent a love letter to Niagara, warts and all, and I just find all of the contradictions fascinating, and mm-hmm. I think that really kind of coming to terms with them and being able to see both the beauty and the power and the lies all together really helps us to appreciate this stupendous part of our history.
Well, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Ginger Strand, thank you so much for talking with us this
afternoon.
Thank
you for having me.
Ginger Strand is the author of Inventing Niagara, Beauty, Power, and Lies. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. And that interview with Ginger Strand was conducted on May 13th of this year. Ginger Strand also has a website. It is www.gingerstrand.com.